meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight's show, we've got lots planned for you. Sadly, the stories that we talk about here are stories that you see in the news. We have the Haley Cummings case now, of course, Kaylee Anthony, Jessica Lunsford, all of these tragic disappearances of these young girls and what we can do about it. I got a big kick out of my guests tonight. Donna Kaufman, you'll know, is a co-author of A Question of Murder. And the co-author with Donna is Dr. Cyril Wecht. You'll know him as the famed forensic pathologist who's currently at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences annual conference. In fact, last night I think he was the keynote speaker. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Yes, thanks.
Hi, Donna. How are you doing?
Hey, Dana. I'm doing fine.
Okay. Dr. Wecht.
Unfortunately, the news is not good in terms of the cases you just outlined.
Oh, man. I'll tell you, every time you turn the TV on, it's just something else and something else. And Dr. Wecht, let's start with you. We've talked about your book before, A Question of Murder. Right now, you're at a forensic sciences conference, and forensic science is so important in all of these cases. In fact, it makes or breaks them, to make a long story short. Tell us about the conference you're at a little bit.
Well, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, which is the largest and most prestigious group of its kind in the world, was founded in 1949 by half a dozen or so of the top guys around at that time. And it has grown ever since, now over 5,000 members. It consists of maybe about 10 sections: pathology, toxicology, criminalistics, entomology, anthropology, question documents,
odontology,
pharmacology, toxicology, general section, and the conference now is host to about 3,500 people attending this particular meeting in Denver at their huge convention center. So the individual sections have their meetings, and then there are plenary sessions. I'm very proud to have been president of the Academy back in 1971-72. And last night, Henry Lee, Michael Bodden, and I gave a presentation. We've now done this, I think this was the sixth consecutive time, following the opening reception, which always used to be a kind of an open evening for people to just relax and go out and enjoy themselves, because the days are cram-packed from morning till night. So we decided to fill that vacuum and deprive them of that little bit of revelry. And we started with special presentations. And last night we did this, talking about new scientific advancements, what they mean. And we talked a lot, by the way, about some of the criticisms of some of the crime labs and forensic scientists that are set forth in a report just released today by the National Academy of Science. So it's not all perfect, but forensic science still remains, obviously, a very, very important, absolutely essential armamentarium in the overall criminal justice system.
Donna Kaufman, co-author of A Question of Murder. When you work with Dr. Wecht and you see these stories, sadly, there are more stories now. You could probably write another book and talk about the cases the way they are. But the public perception of these sorts of cases, how they're investigated, you look at the TV shows like CSI, it's all wrapped up in 30 minutes or 45 minutes. You know, everything is so easy. You go back to my era and you see Jack Webb on Dragnet reaching down with his pen and picking up something, the shell casing, and it was all solved in a couple of minutes. But it's a lot bigger than that. How big of a kick is it for you, Donna, to be able to work with professionals like this?
Oh, you said it exactly. And when I do go to those conferences, it's where the eagles soar. And the top echelon of all those disciplines meet together and talk about past cases, current cases, the future of forensics and law enforcement and legal thinking as well. And I'm like a kid in a candy store there because I'm interested in every aspect of it. So I really enjoy these conferences and getting to know people like Dr. West, who is so astute at breaking down these medical legal issues to things that my readers and my silly brain can understand.
Dr. Weck, there's a difference between working a case like Anna Nicole Smith or a transient named John Smith, or is there really forensics, is it not?
Well, you're right. And in theory, with a sense of complete propriety, every case should be addressed in the same fashion and dealt with utmost diligence, competence, and thoroughness. But, it would be disingenuous of me to say that a case involving a celebrity, a case involving somebody notorious, or a case which has developed notoriety, maybe a serial killers, a brutal rape, sexual assault, that kind of a case doesn't get more attention. It's just natural. Everybody's going to be more keenly aware of what's going on, more up on their toes, so to speak. But good detectives, homicide detectives, good forensic scientists, and good forensic pathologists do approach each and every case the same way in order to make sure that you find the evidence or you find a lack of evidence which goes toward the inculpation, proving the involvement and ultimately the guilt of somebody, or the exculpation, the exoneration, the innocence of somebody, which is at the very least of equal importance. So, there's a great responsibility. I don't want to overplay it and make us out to be great heroes, but the nature of the work is such that if you do what you're supposed to do, you can be very proud of yourself when the day is over and your career is done to know that you have made a contribution, really, not only, to the criminal justice system in terms of that kind of, ethereal and tangible concept, but you have literally saved people's lives. You have brought understanding and solutions to crimes and so on. It's a great opportunity to make a contribution.
Donna, years ago we used to talk about a mailbox on every corner or a kid playing ball on in the playground. Now we talk about pedophiles, how many there are on the block. We see these young kids, Florida, I'm going to pick on them a little bit later on because it seems like these cases seem to turn up there, although it's not just Florida, but the high-profile cases seem to have lately. When you look at this, both as a investigative reporter and author and someone who's followed the crime beat for a long time, when you see the system the way that it is, like I say, a pedophile on every street corner, just how safe is it out there for people? And do we have to worry at night about our child being snatched from their beds?
Well, we should always worry about it. Every parent should worry about their child. We do have internet access that lets you put in a zip code and see where all the pedophiles supposedly live in your area. But we get lulled into thinking that will tell us everything. And we forget about the people who haven't yet been arrested, or the fact that these guys move around and they don't keep up with the reporting of their addresses. And so I think it's important for parents to constantly be paranoid. Don't leave those kids to walk to school by themselves. Don't leave them out playing in the yard where they can be snatched so many children are. But now one of the things we're seeing is these bold predators who come into a home when families are asleep and dogs are there, and they take a child. And we have two of those cases in our book, Danielle Van Dam and Stephanie Crow. She was not kidnapped, but she was murdered in her home by somebody who came in her home, a complete stranger. And these are really troubling cases, and there was not a lot of forensic evidence in either of them, but Dr. Wecht did work on both of those cases, one of which had, they both had terribly different results, satisfactory results.
Dr. Wecht, when you look at these type of high-profile cases, I'll go back to the Lunsford case. I've interviewed the father, Mark Lunsford, on my program many times, and he always was a little bit leery to criticize law enforcement, but the media wasn't. They jumped on that right away about how the girl was found right in the neighborhood. There was questions on forensics. When you look at these sorts of cases, ones you've worked on and others, the high-profile or the low-profile cases, how important is it for that first-line beat cop that attends to the scene to preserve the evidence, because that could make or break the case?
Yes, extremely important. With regard to the Lunsford's case, I don't hesitate to criticize those people, all the investigative law enforcement agencies involved, because that was outright stupidity.
Yep.
And malpractice. There's no question. It is the equivalent of egregious medical malpractice by a physician. Look, everybody knows the classical definition, the description of how a murder investigation proceeds, let's say involving a child. You start right there in the family, right?
Right.
Mommy, daddy, brothers, sisters, and so on. And then you keep widening the circle, relatives, family, friends, and neighbors, and so on. My God, if they just did that, widen the circle, then they're into the trailer of the guy that killed her. And they would have found the girl very likely while she was still alive, because she remained alive for days. Incredible. This is a case that cries out for criticism, for people to learn from it, and it's hard to imagine how in the world, and I forgot to mention, which of course you know, your listeners have to be told about this, that this guy was a known offender.
Yeah.
Not a matter of, they never thought because he was the local minister or the Boy Scout leader. This is a guy that had a track record. I mean, they should have gone to him like dogs on a hound, well-trained hound on a hunt with a fox, that they've got cornered. It's unbelievable. So, and then the second part of the question on the first visit to the scene and so on, got to be very, very careful that you do not unintentionally, of course, but negligently destroy, alter, obfuscate forensic evidence just by walking and moving and touching and so on. You can destroy things that quite literally, without exaggeration, would have led to the identification of the perpetrator. So it's very important in these cases that we're talking about, if somebody is found missing, then first thing you do is don't touch anything. You pick up that phone, you call the police, and you sit tight and you get them there. And you know, by the way, I can't help but remind myself that isn't it interesting in the John Benet Ramsey case.
Yep.
That John and Patsy Ramsey called over two couples, so they had four people in addition to themselves walking around that house while the police were looking for the body and collecting forensic scientific evidence. Keep that in mind, and keep in mind that John and Patsy Ramsey were college-educated, intelligent people. Just plug that in for another day.
Absolutely. It's so important. And Donna, Dr. Wecht makes so much sense when it comes to that aspect of this. But let's look at the other aspect of it. Mark Lunsford, the grieving father, who is, leery to criticize law enforcement, although he has a huge amount of right to, because they blew it. How do you, as a reporter and an author, try to be, I'm going to steal this from Fox News, and they can get after me if they want, fair and balanced, because sometimes these people just blow it, plain and simple.
I had a long talk with Mark, trying to talk some sense into him about that he had an obligation to follow through in seeing that law enforcement did the right thing, and he was reluctant, as you say, to do so. And I wonder if we will find out in the Haley Cummings case if the same mistakes were made. And there are a whole number of them that were made in the Lunsford case.
Yeah.
So many of them, it was just incompetence on many levels. And I wonder, I can't help but wonder if maybe Mark Lunsford had taken a more aggressive stance and filed a civil suit, if we would have seen real changes that make a difference in the Haley Cummings case. That remains to be seen. But one thing I wanted to pick up on that Dr. Weck was saying is when a body is found in a home, the instinct of the family members is to fall upon that body and try to bring life into it, or breathe life into it, or wake up the person. And in doing so, you're getting rid of fingerprints, DNA, hairs, fibers, footprints. Your DNA and footprints and handprints are over the perpetrators. So all of that good forensic evidence is gone. So, you have to kind of resist the inclination, the human inclination to touch a victim. And it's hard to do, but we have to train ourselves that when we see a crime scene, identify it as such.
If you're just tuning in, Dr. Cyril Wecht is here along with Donna Kaufman. They co-authored A Question of Murder. There's a link in the show notes on how to pick up that book. Dr. Wecht, the news media have been all over the Anthony case down in Orlando. Poor little girl. Now the trial will come up eventually. Forensics is going to be a huge part of this case. The defense will question everything from Tim Miller's organization, Texas Equisearch, trying to find the body, to the poor meter reader who did find it, to you name it, and there's not a lot of forensics that we're told about. But have you seen a case like this where there's been so much evidence dropped into the media, or evidence that maybe we're not hearing about, but they're making the media happy by giving them all this non-information?
Well, you say a whole lot of forensics involved. Well, there are some interesting forensics that we've heard about, cadaver in chemical analysis of the automobile and the stain in particular. And then now some things about the duct tape, et cetera. But, the traditional things, the classical, important, essential issues in a homicide case do really not come to bear in this case.
Right.
Forensic pathology is never going to be able to tell you the cause of death, the time, the place, and the mechanism of death, suffocation, strangulation, or whatever. When you have a decomposed body like this, unless you find a bullet hole through a bone, unless you find fractures which are definitely antemortem, involving the cranium, or multiple fractures of the ribcage or so on, you don't know. I did a second autopsy on Lacey Peterson. And this was just the remnants of a body. No head, no neck, no arms, one leg gone, part of another leg gone, no internal organs or tissues of any kind except for the uterus. And the forensic pathologist who did the autopsy quite honestly stated that he could not come up with the cause of death, the time, place, or mechanism of death, and neither could I, which is why I chose not to testify. Go out there and make a lot of money and say nothing, and just reopen the door for the prosecutor to get back to some things that maybe he feels he forgot, or certainly to emphasize things that he deemed important in the case. So back now to Kaylee Anthony. Assuming that nothing comes forward with a couple of hairs from toxicology, and I don't think that it will, that's my prediction.
Right.
But these are tests that have to be done. But pathology, toxicology, anthropology, and odontology, and even entomology, I don't think that they're going to really come to play. The body was there too long, and too decomposed, and too much is missing. This is not to say that these kinds of experts don't examine properly on both sides and come up with their findings, but I predict that Aside from the stuff in the car and the smell and what does it mean, and even will it be allowed under the Daubert rule, which is another matter. I don't go off on that tangent,
right.
And so on. You're not going to get into these other basics because there's no way to argue. You can only engage in conjecture, and that's not going to be admissible, as you know, in a court of law, insofar as expert testimony is concerned. I predict that in this case, if it goes to trial, that the jury, and we won't know this until it's over and maybe some jurors are interviewed, that all of the forensic scientific evidence is going to go in one ear and come out the other ear, and the jury's going to say, hey man, where was this child from June 15th,
yep,
to June 16th to July 15th, a month later? Why didn't she report it? Where were the grandparents? What did she tell the grandparents? Where did this fictitious babysitter come from? And on and on and on. And then all the things about her, the things that she said and she did and wrote, and Donna can talk about that, and so on and so forth. These are the things that are plain common sense, and there's no way in the world, in my opinion, that the defense team is going to be able to overcome that.
Donna, I'm going to give you the last word. What's next for you? Sadly, there will be more high-profile cases like this. Hopefully, Haley Cummings will be found, although, as we all know, each day that she's not may be the worst-case scenario. But what's next for you?
Well, I'm working the Kaylee Anthony case, of course, and I think that there will be some recognizable parts of the trial that you can read about in our Danielle Van Dam chapter in A Question of Murder, because many of those same experts will be there. Now, whether or not they will convince the jury, we'll have to see. But those same experts on both prosecution and defense side are going to be making an appearance in the Casey Anthony trial, which is scheduled to begin in the fall.
Yeah, it should be interesting for sure. Dr. Weck, Donna Kaufman, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. A pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, bye.
All right, this is Scared Monkeys Radio. You know, it's a big kick for me to interview someone like Sarah Wecht and, of course, Donna Kaufman, and forensics is just so important. It's not just CSI on TV. That's real life, baby. We're going to come back with Tim Miller from Texas Echo Search to talk more about the Haley Cummings case and what they've been up to. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. Unfortunately, Tim Miller is not able to join us tonight. As you know, Tim Miller is very busy, and he is down in Florida right now. He and his organization helping with the search for Haley Cummings. So I do apologize for that, and we'll have Tim on again real soon. We're going to take another quick break here. And I don't know, actually, we're going to go right to Mike McIntyre. You'll know Mike McIntyre as a syndicated radio host on the Corson Rocco Radio Networks and a crime reporter for the Winnipeg Free Press. I sat down with Mike a little earlier on today to talk about some of the high-profile cases in the news. Here's Mike. All right, we're back. You know, I happened to be slumming the other day and turned my radio to CBC. I get these yuppie left-wing moments now and then. And I happened to hear my next guest as a guest on a show, although I think the host called him Mac McIntyre, or maybe Mike called himself that. I don't know. But it's always a pleasure to have crime reporter from the Winnipeg Free Press and host of his own show, Crime and Punishment on the Chorus and Rolco Radio Network's Mike McIntyre on with me. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very good, Pena Dretzer.
Yeah, what's with the slumming? What's
well,
with the slumming,
you know,
on CBC?
I was making a point that people seem to get dyslexic sometimes with my name, and more than once I have been called Mac McIntyre. The Mac thing I can understand. Mac isn't that uncommon of a name, I guess. I've never, ever come across anyone with the last name, though, of McIntyre. Always gets a bit of a chuckle when I get a, a phone call returned and people are looking for Mr. McIntyre.
Anyway, let's talk about the CBC a little bit. Adler must be in pain knowing that one of his frequent guests is over on the left wing.
Well, I'm a bit of a I'll go anywhere. I love to talk. So anywhere that wants an opinion on something, I'm happy to give it. But I'm multitasking, I guess, at its finest. And really, at the end of the day, in the new media that's out there, we're all kind of under one big umbrella anyways.
Yeah,
I'm sure the day will come when there's really only one ownership of every media outlet in the world.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think Adler, with all his money, will own them all anyway. So anyway, what I brought you on for tonight, Mike, is I want to talk about some of the high-profile cases in the news, in particular Florida. You know, in Western Canada, we have a Tim Hortons on almost every street corner. In Florida, they have a registered sex offender on almost every street corner. And now we have poor little Haley Cummings. I'm not saying that a sex offender is responsible for this, but it's just when you see these stories, you see Cummings and you see Anthony and you see Lunsford, and I could go on and on and on, and especially Florida, what the heck's going on?
Yeah, and it's interesting, Dana. I was just in Florida. I just got back last week. Actually, had actually been on a cruise. Poor me. But it was based out of Miami, and as I do wherever I travel, I always like to pick up the papers and read the news. And it was around the time that we were down there that this case was just sort of taking off, and that was my first inkling as well. We've seen so many of those cases, as you said, like the Lunsfords, where it has been a sex offender. In fact, it always seems to be one of two things. It's either a sex offender or a family member, and sometimes it's both, a family member who is a sex offender. And I know suspicion usually does start at home in these cases, because statistics show that quite often it is a family member, but you're right, in Florida, it's like pedophiles gone wild down there in some quarters. I know there's websites that you can actually track addresses and whatnot of pedophiles, and there are some places in the U.S. where it's just an incredible concentration of sex offenders over such a small area of land, and you got to feel for the people who have to live amongst them. That can't be a very comforting situation.
Oh, it's tragic, and we all know that the media will cover this story. I'm not sure you can get as much coverage as Anthony has got, or some of the other cases. In fact, even the Lunsford case didn't spiral as much as poor little Kaylee Anthony, but Anthony has gone every direction it possibly could. It will eventually go to trial. I'm waiting for the Leonard Padilla show to come on. I think it'll be on the Comedy Network, personally, but
that would be a very good spot for it after seeing some of his performances.
But you as an author, and of course you wrote the book Devil Among Us, How Canada Failed to Stop a Pedophile, it's always been about liberal left-wing Canada and soft Canada and all this sort of stuff, but I'm wondering if the States is doing just a crappy job with the pedophiles down there, because they're just running rampant.
They are, and yet I think the perception in Canada is that the Americans, they do it right, and Canada ought to follow suit with what its neighbors to the south do in terms of dealing with sex offenders. And there has been certainly some new legislation passed in many states. I mean, one of the unique things about Canada versus the U.S., in Canada, we all fall under sort of one law. What's the same in British Columbia would be the same in Quebec. In the U.S., of course, individual states have different ways of dealing with criminals. Some states are much harsher than others. It's, just like you have the death penalty in some states and not in others. Well, for sex offenders, they tend to deal with them a lot harsher in some states. I know Florida, after like the Lunsford case, has certainly made, I think it's called Jessica's Law,
yep,
which certainly takes a really hardline approach and trying to eliminate those second and third chances for sex offenders. But as you know, Dana, sometimes it just takes one instance, and you can have life or lives that are forever damaged.
If you're just tuning in, Mike McIntyre is here. Speaking of Jessica's Law, and I've interviewed Mark Lunsford many times on my program, and that particular law, although it's the legislature in each state assembly or whatever, that decides to pass the law, but that was really pushed by, conservative talk show host Bill O'Reilly and a regular guest on my program, victims advocate Wendy Murphy, and they really went to town on the states that were either were passing it or weren't passing it, and I think there's about four or five that haven't got it right now. But the power of the press was unbelievable in something like that. How come we don't see something like that up here in Canada? Like, you know, we joke about Charles Adler, but a guy like him that has the listenership that could go out and push on something like that and really get the politicians squirming.
Well, I think it's not just the power of the press, but it's also the power of the people. And, of course, when you're talking about the U.S. states, I mean, everybody is elected down there. Your judges are elected. Your county prosecutor is elected. The district attorney, the sheriff. I mean, these people are all, they have to answer to the public in a way that you don't see that happen in Canada. Sure, our politicians are elected up here, but that's sort of where the buck stops. And of course they all fall under, their whatever party they represent, and they have to sort of toe the party line. And so I think in the U.S. you see that there is a lot more, some critics may call it pandering to the public. But if pandering is the word you want to use to describe beefing up laws to protect children, then I say, I'm all for pandering. I think as well, I mean, we've had some shocking crimes, and the Peter Whitmore case certainly is one, that I documented in my recent book, here in Canada. But by and large, we don't get the volume of horrible cases like you see just in the state of Florida alone, and you've already listed off several just in the last couple years. In Canada, we could probably count on one or two hands the number of those kinds of cases over the last 10, 20 years, where in some states, you can count on one hand the number of cases in a given month or year. And so I think that's perhaps why there's that political will there that we don't see in Canada.
You know, governments today are talking economy, 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 economy. Before, we were talking about the war on terror and crime, and it's become more of an issue now to look at bank investments and failing banks rather than funding police departments. In fact, some states are laying off policemen, cutting back salaries. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police had a salary increase turned back on them. They had to lose their increase, and it's become an issue now where protecting the people may not be the number one priority for governments when they just look at money, money, money. Is that something that the media has created?
I think so, and you know what, Dana? I would argue vehemently that as the economy worsens, as it is in the U.S. and as it is in Canada, if anything, it's in times like that that you need more law enforcement. Look at some of the cases that we've all read about and perhaps reacted in shock and horror to. Mass murders within families, distraught fathers and husbands who lose their jobs, who then wipe out their entire family. Just had a huge case like that in California. There was another case around Christmas in California as well, where the man posed as Santa Claus and wiped out a whole family. I think as the economy gets worse, people get more desperate, and in fact, that's the time when you want to be beefing up law enforcement, because you need to in order to deal with what I believe is going to be a very dramatic spike, and we're already seeing it. And whether it's the distraught father wiping out his family, or just the desperate drug addict who's going to go rob the local convenience store because he's out of money, I think crime in general is going to go up as the economy goes down, and I would hope that people in a decision-making capacity recognize this and will keep those funds flowing to law enforcement. You need those frontline officers out there, or else you have anarchy.
And you need to equip those frontline officers. We just look at the taser issue. I remember when pepper spray first came out, and there were some reported deaths because of what allegedly was caused by a pepper spray, and as soon as the media grabbed onto it, the politicians panicked. Yes, there may be tighter regulations that need to be done, but all of a sudden now with tasers, you look at the media is stepping forward, reporting some of the terrible cases. They're not reporting the cases where law enforcement were able to use a taser, were able to disarm or subdue a suspect and save a bunch of people. They're just reporting the negative stuff, and all of a sudden now police departments are fighting to even have their frontline officers equipped properly enough to protect themselves and the public. And I think it's just sad. When's the last time a politician has come forward to say, because a police officer needs to be tased before he can carry one, how about try one of those on me and we'll make up our own mind?
Well, you're right, and we've seen a real, we are seeing a real clawback in Canada with taser use, and it's based on a few, what I would suggest are pretty isolated cases. Let's not forget a lot of the people who are being tasered and the people that are dying of being tasered, they likely have all kinds of other issues going on. A lot of times they're high on drugs. A lot of times these are people who have abused their bodies, be it through drug use or alcohol or other substances. These are not necessarily healthy, able-bodied people who are dropping dead after getting a taser. And let's also keep in mind why these people are being tasered. They're being tasered because without the taser, the next level of force would be immediately lethal, the gun. And the taser is supposed to be a sort of an intermediary between, you know, fists and feet, which we all know, I mean, once police get into a drag-em-down, knuckles-out brawl with suspects, well, then all kinds of things can go wrong. The taser is supposed to be a go-between between lethal force and something that puts the officer at extreme risk. And I know a lot of police officers are very frustrated because they see what they think is a very effective tool being taken away from them based on, you know, perhaps a knee-jerk reaction to a handful of cases.
Yeah, and shame on the government for not supporting the officers when it comes to this, because running and putting your tail between your legs is not solving the issue. Mike, what's coming up on your show Sunday?
On the show this Sunday, we're going to be doing all kinds of stuff, Dana, and I wish I could give you a little more detail at this point. What are we, only Wednesday? So
that's right.
I tend to like to make the show as current as possible, wait till the week goes on, but you can be darn sure that we'll have lots of open lines. In fact, just this past Sunday, I mentioned I'd been away, so I had two straight weeks of just tape shows, and we threw open the phone lines this past week and just got an incredible number of callers. Always nice to hear from the masses, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about some of the cases that I've been covering this week. One in particular, and it sort of flows with what you had already talked about with sex offenders. I'm actually covering a trial this week here in Winnipeg, where I'm based out of, involving a multi-time high-risk pedophile who is now on trial again for molesting an 8-year-old boy at the Red River Exhibition, which is a massive summer festival in Winnipeg. This boy's mother apparently had no idea the man she was dating is a pedophile many times over, with a record that goes back some 15 years. And unfortunately, her 8-year-old boy, if the allegations are true, paid a very heavy price. We're already getting a lot of reaction to the stories I've written in the Winnipeg Free Press, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that story on the weekend.
Yeah, sounds like a good one. And Mike's show is heard on the Chorus and Rolco Radio Networks up here in Canada, and of course he could be found online. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Dana. Take care.
Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Mike McIntyre, and it's always good to have him on the show. And check out his webpage by going to our show notes and just click on the link there. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And that's right, we will be right back with Alexis Moore. She's an expert in cyber stalking. And the data furnishing companies, you got to wonder about that. You know, your name gets sold to here, it gets picked up there, and all of a sudden there's an identity theft problem. And we're going to tie in a little bit the identity theft, the data furnishing issue, cyber stalking, just how bad it is out there right now. Like, technology is a wonderful thing, but it's also being used by the bad people, the criminals out there, to stalk you, to harass you, to ruin your credit, to do everything they possibly can. And my next guest, Alexis Moore, in fact, wrote an article that was featured on Michelle Obama's webpage about just that. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
All right, we're back. I want to continue talking about cyber stalking and technology and all that sort of stuff and how it affects those that are being, you know, stalked. Have you ever got a phone call from a credit agency or someone and you're wondering how the hell did they ever get your name? Data furnishing is a big problem, and it also affects cyber stalking, and it's a multi, not million, but my opinion, billion-dollar industry. Nothing more sickening than getting a phone call from a bank that you'd never heard of before or somebody trying to sell you something, but there's a much bigger picture. Alexis Moore is an expert when it comes to cyber stalking, and I thought I'd bring her back on the program to talk about that. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dana. Thanks for having me.
You wrote an article that ended up on Michelle Obama's website. Let's talk about that first.
Sure. I was approached by Linda Lowen, who is a guide for About.com, Women's Issues, and she asked me for January, which is National Stalking Awareness Month, to do a piece on cyber stalking. And it's something that's not often reported on, and I was happy to do it, and it's been a fantastic opportunity to get the word out about the use of technology to stalk and harass, which is the definition or what I call cyber stalking in a nutshell.
Absolutely. You and I have talked about this on the program before, but for those that are tuning in for the first time or maybe haven't heard you and I discuss this on the program, just what is cyber stalking? When people hear about stalking, you know, they think of celebrities and, the, you know, the crazy obsessed fan and all that sort of stuff, but there's a lot of crazy obsessed husbands, boyfriends, whatever out there that are wanting to make their former partner's life a living hell.
You bet. And, you know, Dana, it's not just former partners. It's not just someone that you've had a relationship, necessarily an intimate relationship with. It's happening more and more frequently to even those folks that you do business with. The economy has a drastic impact these days on folks' tempers and their ability to cope. You know, it's becoming worse and worse. And there are situations now even being reported where women and men both are saying that whether they be in the business of the banking industry or real estate, they're encountering cyber attacks, which take place online, you know, unwanted emails or folks creating online accounts using your name or likeness to humiliate, harass, embarrass, those sorts of things. It's happening more and more just because folks are turning to the online or to the internet because it is a way of doing so, harming people without being known. There's an anonymous factor, and you can commit a lot of havoc and harm upon a person behind the scenes without even leaving your home or office. So we're seeing it more and more frequently now, not just with intimate partner relationships, but also with business professionals, neighbors who are upset about a barking dog. In fact, I mean, there's so many cases now that it's almost amazing that we haven't heard more from the media, but for whatever reason, I'm here to say that cyber stalking is out there, it's happening, and it's impacting millions of people, including teenagers and seniors and those of us in business and that sort of thing. So really, there is no one that's immune from cyber stalking today.
I think you make a really good point about the media is we don't hear about this a lot, or maybe when it does come on, we don't pay attention to it because it's not affecting us, although we may not even know that it's affecting us because the internet and technology, the way that it is so broad and so open that a lot of people that maybe get up and age a little bit, you know, they may come on, check their email, they may do something, but they don't really understand how it works. But something I wanted to talk to you about while we have you here, Alexis Moore is here, if you were just tuning in, ladies and gentlemen, and we're talking about cyber stalking, is data furnishing, and that is so important, and it's such a big business. And you look at the names and the numbers and the dollars that go through this. What does that mean, data furnishing?
Well, data furnishing, in the nutshell, is exactly what it sounds like. It's individuals or entities that are out there selling consumer private records or data. And I know it could be social security numbers, it can be bank account information, you can get safe deposit box information, license plate records. Oh gosh, there's just an enormous amount of information, medical records. All of these things now are being compiled and sold online. And in some instances, they're public record anyway, like a criminal conviction record or a record pertaining to real estate and that sort of thing, property ownership. However, what's dangerous is we have the data furnishers selling this information to the public and these agencies are not licensed. And that's where I've been a big advocate, and that's where I have the issue, is the industry in a whole. I can understand why they're needed. All of us want to be able to go online and do research, and those of us that are in the media or advocates like myself or in the law enforcement arena or those that are in the legal profession have a need for data furnishing to get, you know, to check facts and to do something legal with the data. However, because it is a billion-dollar industry and there is such a need for information these days, and easy information, meaning with the click of the mouse, you can ascertain almost any record, that's the problem. We have no one out there really regulating any of this industry. I mean, just about anybody these days can go into the business of being a data furnisher, or what they also call an information broker.
And, you know, some cases, we hear about them all the time, are accidental. In fact, my own personal family, wife ends up getting a parking ticket in another city about an hour away. That city sends us a letter saying, oops, your license plate information was accidentally sent out to a survey group that was looking at parking trends in the city. Not only did they want to know how many parking tickets they got, in the city, but we also sent your name, your address, your driver's license number and everything. Oh, we're so sorry. And when you hear about that and you hear about doctor's offices closing and the records are found in the garbage and all that sort of stuff, some of it is intentional. Some of it is just plain stupid when it comes to Big Brother. Your thoughts?
You're right, Dana, exactly. What's happening is we have created basically a monster. You know, the online or the internet age and the internet era, this was all created without a lot of, in my opinion anyway, a lot of thought as to what was going to be the future. The excitement and all of us being able to go online and do all these wonderful things that we do and search and what have you, it's fantastic. However, no one realized, like you're mentioning, once records go online, there's no taking them off permanently. No matter who you talk to, what banking agency or entity, even our federal government, no one's going to guarantee you 100% that any record that's been online by mistake, including our court records that have Social Security numbers and those sorts of things, no one is going to say that they can completely, I quote, wipe out the records, because it's impossible. So we went online, in my opinion, too fast with many, many records, including those involving the courts, because in many cases, the courts also had Social Security numbers on many, many documents. And that's what we're finding. And so we made mistakes in the beginning. And then, of course, those working in the banking industry and those of us with credit cards were very well aware that we get these letters now and again. I just got one from Capital One, for example, that said we had a data breach.
Yep.
And those are these are the types of cases I'm speaking about. Plus, we have already these agencies and entities known as the data furnishers, and also the information brokers out there who are one step below a private investigator, meaning that they're not licensed, they're not regulated. It's basically a wild, wild west. You can go out there and sell these records, make tons of money, many of which they get by with a lot of the licensing, which is iffy. And if I'm going to say licensing, I'm meaning that it's very, very negligible to say that they're really licensed, but they have what's known as a hold harmless. So you check a box as an individual purchasing a private record, indicating that it's for a lawful purpose, and that's how they get over the hump of selling a private record. But again, doing all of this behind our backs, you're never notified as a consumer when a private record is sold. So, for example, if we were to go online and want to do a Social Security number trace or a bank account trace, you could do this with a data furnishing company, and someone buy my Social Security number or my banking account information, and I'm never notified.
Yeah.
And that's where, again, there's a threefold issue here that I'm advocating in legislation as well as an advocate for privacy protection. We've already got the data furnishing companies out there. The information brokers, they're out there. They're making money. It's going to be very difficult to shut any of these agencies down, because the minute you close a website, they'll just reappear somewhere else. And so rather than try to, quote, do the impossible or to even think that's realistic, my opinion is, as a professional who worked as a high-tech investigator as well as now a victim of cyberstalking, I have to say that I believe wholeheartedly if a consumer was notified every time a data furnisher sold our records, so if someone went in and bought Dana Presser's social or your bank account or your employment records or any record for that matter, you should be notified who received the records, the name of the third party, and also what record was sold. Because if it's really for a legitimate reason, I wouldn't think that this would be a problem.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why identity theft also oftentimes will be encompassed with the cyber stalking crime. For a while, their experts were calling cyber stalking, and many times identity theft is abuse. And that's more or less what I encountered for quite a while as well, because I had an experience with an individual who I was in a relationship with, was using my name and likeness and what have you, and creating websites, opening and closing bank accounts with my name. My credit cards were often either canceled or the address was changed fraudulently because this individual had information about me. So now it's called cyber stalking, but before we even knew what this crime was even called, or because there really wasn't a law in place or any sort of understanding, we were calling it identity theft as abuse. So for the listener, to understand more why cyber stalking crime should be taken seriously, it's because they involve the use of consumer private information, which is no longer private if we really want to just put a label on it. We no longer have the privacy that we did, say, 15, even 20 years ago. I mean, it's just today the Internet has created a whole new arena, and it impacts even those that do not use the computer. The majority of victims out there can tell you that they don't bank online. They never have. They shred all their documents. Most of them are very, very diligent about keeping everything safe. However, it doesn't take much for an individual to go online and just to buy the record, regardless if you bank online or not, because the banking industry and all of these other agencies are electronic and the records are compiled electronically. So regardless if you own a computer, bank online, or have any private information stored in your computer, the listeners need to realize that the information is still out there regardless.
You're working with a San Francisco Assemblywoman's office regarding legislation, and I think it's about time to start protecting the people rather than big business. Tell us about the Assemblywoman, who she is, and what you're working on.
Sure. It's been 4 years now since I've been working with lawmakers trying to get their ear and understanding in regards to privacy protection. And California Assemblywoman Fiona Ma finally, I found someone who understands. She herself has been victimized by identity theft. So it was really a blessing to be able to reach out to her and have her say, I want to know how this happened, because, again, I'm a public official and I'm not going to speak for her, but I can tell you that it did take me finding that one lawmaker who actually has experienced identity theft to understand what this privacy breach feels like. Because, again, cyber stalking does mirror oftentimes identity theft, because so many of the techniques used are similar, because the individuals out there are using your personal information against you. Except an identity theft victim has been victimized financially, where cyber stalking victims are normally, it's a method to control, harass, humiliate, embarrass, those sorts of things. Nonetheless, Fiona Ma has been very receptive. She is working, as we speak, her office on reviewing legislation that I am proposing that would mandate that every data furnishing company out there that sells a California consumer record have to be licensed, very similar to the licensing of a private investigator. And then the second part of the legislation has to do with the data furnishers themselves providing notice to the consumer anytime they sell a private record. Therefore, when a victim, potential victim rather, of identity theft, or any consumer, receives notice, we have a fighting chance. If we look at the piece of paper and say, gosh, you know, I didn't authorize this individual to access my credit or my Social Security number or my banking information or whatever it may be, a red flag can go up, and at least we can fight back and close bank accounts or do what we need to do. And then the third part of the bill, which is key, is the evidentiary measures. Presently, the main reason why identity theft crimes and stalking crimes are not prosecuted is for lack of evidence.
Right.
And with this particular legislation or this piece I'm working on, we would mandate that all data furnishers in the state of California, and hopefully this will expand, will be mandated to maintain their records for a specific period of time. I'm opting for 10 years because that seems to be reasonable when you think about tax and different laws we have. That seems to be a good number. However, any number is better than what we have now, which is nothing. I reached out to several of the large data furnishers, including LexisNexis and some of them, and asked them, how do I get records? How do I show that this individual has been buying my private records and information? It was virtually impossible. They do not keep records for any specific period of time, and if someone says they do, I'd like to talk to that person, because it's every time an individual like myself or another reports a crime like cyber stalking or identity theft to law enforcement, you find their standard procedure, which is just to take a report for quote information purposes,
yep,
that you can clean up your mess, so to speak, and get your credit maybe back in shape after, you know, for some months of hard work. But nothing is usually done. You don't hear about a lot of cases being prosecuted. You definitely don't hear many positive endings, happy endings. It's just a matter of a lot of paperwork and time. So hopefully with the evidence being preserved as part of this legislation, we will have a fighting chance to give law enforcement the tools that they need and the prosecutors the tools that they need to start putting some of these bad guys where they belong and make them pay for what they've done.
Yeah, and how important is that, especially the tools for law enforcement? Even when you look at a child porn investigation, a lot of the forensic computer investigators in the bigger departments and smaller departments that's non-existent are waiting for a year or more to even have a computer analyzed. So if you're looking for stolen data on a computer or a kiddie porn or whatever, it's just not getting done because the money isn't there and the manpower isn't there, and hopefully the legislation that you're working on will help with that. Just before I let you go, Alexis Moore, let's talk a little bit about and maybe give some quick advice to someone who thinks that maybe they are being cyber-stalked or their identity has been stolen. Because even to try and get, you know, to call Equifax or one of the credit bureaus to find out if somebody's been messing with your credit is a big hassle. Sometimes it costs you money. It's your credit, but you have to pay to access it. How can people, what can they do and what can we do to help? What's your advice?
My advice first and foremost is to take any threat you have, whether it be an incident at work or something in a personal relationship or what have you, take it serious. Protect your private information. And what I mean by that is your first and foremost step for any privacy protection would be your home address. Meaning, if you do business publicly, as many of us do, I have a real estate license and have my advocacy organization. I never use my home address on anything. And one thing that a lot of us fail to do is protect our home, which I say is our castle. So using a private mailbox, et cetera, now called UPS Store, and some of these will really help because it's a deterrent when someone's looking to harm or harass. If you make what I call these roadblocks, if you make it difficult, oftentimes they will stop. So, for example, if you're an individual that is in business and very public, using an alternative address is a very good idea to receive your mail. They'll accept certified mail, packages, all of that for you. And it just puts that one roadblock in place that will help. And the second thing, and I always say to... There's top three things, and the address is number one. Number two is your passwords. People say all the time to me, oh, the password, they never ask for it, and I call the bank, and a lot of times they don't even say anything about the password. Well, that's your job as a consumer. If you're dealing with the public and in the private sector, and you're paying these high interest rates, and we're paying for all these services with the banks and your credit card company, even your cellular telephone company, if you call and they do not ask for your password, why are you doing business with them?
Exactly.
So again, this won't protect you 100% or be foolproof, but when you're dealing with a vicious cyber stalker or a case of identity theft, 9 times out of 10, it's because you didn't do your due diligence to say, gosh, you know, I called today to XYZ company and you did not ask me for a password. I want to speak to your manager, and if you're not satisfied, you no longer do business with these people. And the last thing is to take all threats, regardless of how you feel or what someone tells you, take them serious. Your third eye, or I say your gut feeling, is usually right. If you're online and someone starts sending out emails to you, or the same email address comes up over and over that you're not familiar with, find out why. I mean, be sure to put it in the junk mail, but keep notes of who's sending you emails. And if you're not comfortable or familiar with who is sending you something, do not open the email. And if someone at work is looking at you funny, or if you've got a neighbor that's maybe not acting the same way, ask them. Because a lot of times a cyber stalker will get access to your computer or has gained some sort of personal knowledge and has contacted individuals, third parties, and said something about you. For example, I had a case here recently where a gentleman who owned a tax franchise had let an employee go, and the employee had emailed what appeared to be an email from him that had a lewd act that he was performing in the email to his entire contact list at the office.
Oh, God.
And instead of this individual asking why people were looking at him funny or just saying to his secretary, hey, what's going on, he waited too long.
Yep.
So if you see something strange going on around you, I mean, folks act funny, you can tell, ask. Because you never know. Like I said, these cyber attacks are a hidden attack. They're nothing that normally the person doesn't know about it until it's too late. But if you're aware that this sort of thing is happening, education and awareness and that factor, they're both very important. And not being afraid to say, gee, you know, you're acting a little strange today, to your coworker or to even a spouse, to learn maybe that they did get an email or something strange happened, and take these things seriously. It's happening to a lot of folks. They say 1 in 4. So 25% of us will encounter something like this. So by educating yourself and others that you work with, your family, your children, you're going to have a better time overcoming, that's for sure.
Great advice always comes from Alexis Moore, and you're welcome on the program anytime. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I had an incident with a bank, a reputable bank, and when I called in, the customer service rep asked me, I think what he was wanting to ask me is my mother's maiden name, and then he was going to ask me, they must have a list, what my postal code or my zip code is, and he ended up asking me what my mother's zip code was. It became really confusing after that, but cyber stalking and identity theft is certainly nothing to mess with, and it is all about education, and that's what we try to do here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we are right back, and I thought I would bring on one of my favorite guests, ADA out of Los Angeles County, Robin Sachs. You'll know her as an author, safety expert, one of the co-hosts of the Justice Interrupted radio show, and I wanted to bring her on to talk about what's been going on in the news this week. There's three or four different stories that Robin and I can talk about. Evening, ma'am.
Good evening. How are you, Dana?
I'm doing fine. Drew Peterson, who I get slammed every time I bring him on to the program. In fact, I got an interesting comment. I put it up on the webpage from a listener today saying, commenting about how Drew Peterson went on a talk radio show in Chicago, and he challenged Geraldo Rivera to a boxing match without gloves. And if you remember a few years back, if you're an old fart like me, the kid from the Partridge Family, Danny Bonaducci, he challenged Greg Brady, Barry Williams, to a boxing match, and it was just a cheap publicity stunt. So Peterson's done this now. So I get this email today, and I put it up on the webpage saying, Pretzer, you bum, you bring on Peterson all the time, and you're so nice to him, so soft to him. It's too bad they went on another show to announce this. Maybe they'll let you be their ring announcer. So I thought, oh my God.
Well, I would love to see that.
I love it. You know, it's nuts.
I'd sell tickets to that.
But if I was Joel Brodsky, I'd take my client and I'd give him a swift kick in the butt saying, what in the hell are you doing? You know, he's always come on my program and said that he hates the media following him around. He can't stand the media bothering him. They're making him look like be a bad guy. Now he's just playing cheap publicity games. But your thoughts on the Geraldo-Drew Peterson match? I think Geraldo would kick his ass, to be quite honest with you.
Well, I have to tell you, it's kind of crazy. I have to say that the fact that Drew Peterson thinks that the listeners are a bunch of, you know, idiots out here who don't follow this case. I mean, the guy hasn't met a camera, a phone, a radio show that he hasn't liked. So to then say, you know, and maybe you have have been a little soft on him, but you're a consummate gentleman to whomever is on your show, which is why people love being on your show. But at the same time, it's interesting, and I love Joel Brodsky in his own way. But I think that clients pick lawyers a lot like themselves.
Yep.
And only if Joel wanted to, you know, have some control over him, he would. But I think Joel also likes being in front of the camera, as do I and a lot of other people.
Yep.
And so I think that Drew Peterson specifically seeks out people who let him do that. And no one holds the reins on him. If you notice, in quite a different scenario, Mark Garagos right now is representing someone, well-known Chris Brown in Los Angeles.
Yep.
While I'm not at liberty to speak about the case itself, you haven't seen anything until a one or two sentence press release on Sunday from the powers that be in the handlers in the Brown family who issued a statement, not being paraded in front of a television or a camera or anything else like that. And I think Mara Garagos is here to tell you that Scott Peterson, you know, dug himself in and did himself a number. And those statements on TV and cameras, you betcha that they're going to be used no matter where. And Geraldo will probably take him on for just that reason, to see if he can be the one to shake something out that will be used in a trial.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's why I have him come on here and let him talk at free will, too, now and then. But anyway, that's besides the point. When you look,
I digress, sorry.
When you look at the news, and now we have Haley Cummings in Florida. Florida has become I used the analogy earlier on tonight when I had Cyril Wecht on, talking about up here in Canada, we have a convenience store on each corner, or a mailbox, or a kid playing ball. In Florida, you have a registered sex offender on every corner. In fact, it just scares the hell out of you when you see how many are living in your neighborhood. Now, all of a sudden, we have another case in Florida, poor Haley Cummings. We have the Anthony case, we have Lunsford, we have Kessie. I can go on and on. I'm not sure if it's just Florida, but when you look at the way that the government and the judicial system is handling these sex offenders, these pedophiles, it's just not working, because we're seeing more and more of these cases and it turning into tragedy.
Well, there's so many issues that you in that statement just brought up in terms of my mind. First of all, we look at the numbers, and the numbers are there and have been there. I don't want people to listen to these shows, our show, your show, Nancy Grace, and anybody else who talks about these cases, and think that, oh, there's some random issue going on in Florida. The reality is that the Florida has got a great access to information and discovery, and the police put everything up and they really share information, and so we're able to see what's going on there and get a look at two very different cases, one involving a family member, which is very often the people we look at in terms of abusive children, and then also look at the potential for there in the Haley case to be a stranger. And I think that, you know, we would be remiss to say that this stuff has been going on. You know, Dana, you deal with these cases all the time in your own jurisdiction, and as I do, and this isn't that surprising.
No.
It's just that people are finally getting it, and people are picking up on, we need to do something.
And listen, law enforcement is doing a great job. The only time I've ever questioned law enforcement, and we did it again a little bit tonight, Cyril Wecht and I, is the Lunsford case. They just blew it, plain and simple, there. But that's another case to talk about another day.
Cyril Wecht will also tell you, you know, JonBenet Ramsey, and I just actually watched a great show, a little plug for Dr. Wecht, I actually watched a show, I believe it was on the History Channel last night, of him dissecting seven cases, where it really makes you think from a prosecutor's point of view, looking at some of the information and how police investigations can be botched up, and sometimes going to the experts are the place to go.
And just by coincidence, we talked about some of those cases tonight, so if you didn't get to hear the show live, make sure and listen to the replay. One last story, you know, it's sad, it's tragic. The media is being their typical sloppy selves over it. This poor lady with a 200-pound monkey.
Oh. not the octoplets, the monkey we're talking about.
Yeah, the monkey. The, you know, 200 pounds, the thing could get up and go to the bathroom, would log on to the computer, had a glass of wine at night, more pajamas and stuff. God, it's just, anyway, the headlines we're seeing today, chimpanzee goes bananas, dumb stuff like that. Here's a fact. I've had the Humane Society of North America people on my program before. I've even had some of the Fruit Loops from PETA come on here before. But the bottom line is this lady, she never had a 200-pound monkey. Now her friend is near death because the thing attacked it. It attacked a couple of policemen in a police car, ripped the mirror off the car. They ended up having to shoot it several times. But here, because you're a media gal now, the media grabs a story like that, tries to make fun of it a little bit, but there's a tragic side to it. But the big picture is that the poor animal and the poor people, they should never have been mixed together in a residential home.
Well, and again, you bring up a ton of issues. I mean, I look at it, and because when you're talking about it, it's kind of like the octuplet case. It's kind of a similar thing. Like, there is some underlying sickness in not only the newsworthy factor of a case like the chimpanzee and the octuplets, but then also the fact that the stuff really happens. And it really makes you stop and go, are you kidding me that they're, I mean, it seems like it's so surreal, but things like that do, and I guess it really does remind us that the things that you think are impossible to happen in society do, and animals and people, just shows how not together narcissistic and crazy everyone is out there.
Anyway, what's coming up on Justice Interrupted? I know you just did a show. What's going on next week, or how's the show going? I know that Dietrich is kind of miserable most nights, but you and Susan are okay.
I know. Well, we try. You know, Stacey, you know, we have to work with her. But we love our team. Justice Interrupted team is rocking right now with lots of great, interesting cases. And thanks to you and our friends who listen to the show, we get all kinds of great guests. Heather Steele has been a real hit on our show. Yeah. She's part of the Innocent Justice Organization. We've had defense attorneys. We had Mr. Brodsky on. You know, we kind of steal the guests from your show and use them on ours.
That's all right. You know, maybe maybe we can get...
That's because, you know, a friend of yours is a friend of ours.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we can get Drew Peterson and Leonard Padilla come on and do circus tricks on your show sometime.
I'd like to see if you can get Jose Baez on and see what he's going to do now. That's what I want to know.
Yeah, exactly. Because
if you could do that, I would definitely be tuned in, and look forward to being on the radio with you on Justice Interrupted soon. We definitely want you on the show because you're always in the know, and we're happy to have you on anytime.
Well, we were talking just before I let you go, Cyril Wecht and I tonight, about the Anthony case and the forensics, and it should be really interesting to see what happens. Anyway, thank you for coming on. I want you to stay on the line for a second, and I want to talk to you off air about something. And
absolutely.
Yeah, that's Robin Sachs, ADA out of Los Angeles County. I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Remember the webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can come on and listen to the show live, listen to podcasts of past shows, a daily commentary, whatever. You can even say I should be the ring announcer for Geraldo and Drew Peterson. I don't really care. Thank you all. We'll see you. Good night.
This has been the Dana Pretzer Show. Visit us online at scaredmonkeysradio.com. Thanks for listening.